Okay, welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. Jason Williams, along with co-host Sherry Coolidge, Silent Phil in the ones and twos. Today, a special guest, brand new Cincinnati City Council member, Steve Gooden, Republican, freshly appointed by probate judge Ted Winkler to temporarily replace Jeff Pastor's seat as he serves suspension in the wake of federal bribery charges. Sherry?
All sentences that are still shocking.
Still shocking. The beat rolls on. I mean, just still so much up in the air. One of those things that is up in the air, Sherry, is P.G. Sittenfeld. He continues on Cincinnati City Council in the wake of his arrest almost 2 weeks ago. Still in the mayor's race, Sherry. What people are talking about it. Is PG going to resign? Is he going to accept a suspension? As Dave Yost, the attorney general, has begun the process of trying to suspend PG Sittenfeld from the council. Is he going to drop out of the mayor's race? Is he going to run for mayor? Is he going to stay in the race? What are you hearing out there, Sherry?
We can only go on what he has said, which is that he's still planning on running for mayor. He said this himself in a statement that he put out via Twitter. And so he has said this. I have no reason to believe otherwise at this point. But I did hear an interesting fact this morning that I did not know. The minutia sometimes is so important.
Yes.
So I heard. So you need how many signatures? 1,000?
1,000, yes. Yeah. 1,000 ballot signatures.
So, and I assume, I mean, we've known he's running. He probably has these. They're just not turned in yet. That people can only sign one mayoral petition. Like, I thought you could sign them all, right? It's a petition. Like, yeah, he'd be a good mayor. He'd be a good mayor. She'd be a good mayor. But no, you can only sign one. So if these signatures, any of these signatures were gathered before, you know, this was revealed, you know, what happens if people maybe don't feel that same way and they want to support someone else, but those signatures then go this way? It is no easy thing to gather signatures, by the way. Like, 1,000 doesn't seem like a high number, but it is a very high number, especially in a pandemic.
Yeah.
Did you know that? I didn't know that.
I didn't. I knew it was 1,000 valid signatures. I didn't know that, you know, John Doe couldn't sign P.G. Sittenfeld's and Kelly Prather's. I didn't realize, like, I just figured that one person could sign, you know, however many petitions of people are running for. I didn't realize you were limited to only signing one candidate's petition.
So, I mean, you could see then a petition, but maybe people on that petition have changed their mind.
So with the concern, do you think, is that, you know, it could hinder another candidate? You know, it could go out and get a bunch of, you know, signatures, and then a bunch of those are rendered they're nullified because those people had signed PGs. Is that maybe a concern out there?
Not necessarily a concern, but something that's happening. I mean, honestly, even before any of this happened, I think a lot of people were like, you know, this is going to be a tough choice. I mean, David Mann is very well respected in his party, as is P.G. Sittenfeld going into all of this. And that, you know, I definitely talked to people who were like, I don't know. I don't know who I'm actually going to support once I, you know, kind of walk in that voting booth. I like them both. I feel like they're both very similar. They both have very similar visions for the city. And so that was something I think that we were going to see, like a divergent, that they were going to try and make their own paths as we go forward and show that they were different. But if you look at their votes on things and such going back, they're similar. They're both Democrats and just, you know, with the same kind of vision, economic development related to the streetcar and things like that. And so, I mean, like, all bets are off now. I don't know really what the path forward is, what it looks like for everybody, but I have no reason to believe that P.G. Sittenfeld is not still planning on running.
It's, what's the word I'm looking for? Baffling to think that he still thinks he's running for mayor. It also raises another question. I had a text from someone last night who had given to PG's campaign And this person just raised the question, like, what happens to the money? That obviously, as of right now, he's still running. But if he drops out, and, you know, what happens to the war chest of money that people have given to his campaign? That's probably, I mean, that's more questions than, you know, to come, you know, that are going to be, I mean, maybe answered.
He can take that money and he can use it to support other candidates, even if he's not running. He can continue to use it for his run. That money, there's no provision that it needs to be given back or anything like
there's
that.
No legal, there's no legal.
It is his.
You can't claw the money back from in the league. You know, you can't give the money as a donor and say, you know, hey, I want that back. And there's no legal, you know, ramifications for being able to get that money back. Yes, correct.
I mean, so, I think we've seen in some of, like, the PAC money that people have gotten, you know, from, like, the householder PAC, and then even this, I'm hearing some people, you don't give, if you've gotten money, I'm hearing that people are giving it to charity and not using it.
Yeah.
Just kind of, you know, make that path, you know, as clean as possible. With the flow of the money, and so giving it to charity.
Yeah. Still a lot of things to cover, a lot of questions to be asked and answered. And I think this is going to a story that's going to keep us busy for quite a while, Sherry.
I mean, I would say yes to that as I look at my list here of things, lots of things I need to write about.
Let's go ahead and jump to our special guest today and get to know Steve Gooden. All right, special guest time here. That's the Cincinnati podcast. Really pleased to welcome in freshly sworn in council member, Cincinnati City Council member, Steve Gooden. Steve, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
Hey, thanks. Thanks. Good morning to both of you.
On Tuesday morning, yesterday was a whirlwind of Steve being named to temporarily replace Jeff Pastor, and then with an actual swear again. Yesterday rolled fast.
Right. Yeah, it was something. You know, I wasn't, you know, quite sure how it was all going to go down or if it was going to go down. So it certainly had to change my plans, you know, for the day. But absolutely worth it and happy to do it. It was a little bit surreal. You know, City Hall is closed. So, you know, I was sort of ushered in and out, sort of in City Hall for all of about 5 minutes to take the oath, make some quick remarks, and get the hell out. So it was... it was not the typical swearing in, but these are different times.
Your career, you started your career. We'd like to, you know, for folks who are, you know, especially you being new right. to council, we like to have people share their stories and you know, about their career and their life. And you started your career as a journalist. Is that correct?
No, I did. I wasn't a very good one. I think you guys have done better at it than I did. But no, when I was in college, that's absolutely what I thought I was going to do with my life. I started out, I was an English major with a focus in journalism, Miami University. I started there in 1988, got involved with the student newspaper there and ended up editing the student newspaper. And had a series of internships with the Cox newspaper chain. I grew up in Springfield, Ohio, and ended up, you know, working at that newspaper for a couple summers, and actually started there as a general assignment reporter when I graduated. But a couple things kind of happened to me. I was doing a lot of court reporting, covering trials and so forth, covering criminal cases. And I sort of kind of got the bug, you know, to, you know, in an interest in law, you know, really as a reporter. And as you know, back then, I mean, the business has changed so tremendously. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I marvel at how you guys do it with all the different platforms that you have to be on and engage with. I mean, for back when I did this, it was pretty simple. You know, you had to produce about a 10 to 15 column inch story every day on something.
Yeah.
You know, and it was, you know, you got a time frame to do it in, and, you know, breaking news was treating in a different way. I mean, cable news was really just kind of breaking through. So I sort of saw the old version of the profession and loved it, but was also very aware it was changing. So I ended up leaving that job, going to work in the Ohio General Assembly for a year as a legislative aide, you know, and from there went to the Peace Corps. For reasons I'm still sort of, I guess, sort of still trying to figure out internally. But I just had a real desire to travel and do something radically different. So I went over to North Africa in the very tip of Morocco down the Sahara Desert for a year and worked as something called a sanitation engineer, which meant I was digging outhouses for people who didn't really want outhouses. That's another whole podcast to talk about that experience, but it was a fascinating experience. It really got my feet wet with a lot of NGOs and other groups that work abroad. So it was a really kind of expanded my horizons a bit and really got me enabled me to travel a lot and to see a lot of places where that I had a guy like me typically wouldn't get to go. I came back, went to law school at the University of Cincinnati, with the sort of intent on going into the Army as a JAG lawyer full time. I was not able to find a spot or to get in. So while I was sort of waiting to work on that, I ended up going to work at the Hamilton County Prosecutor's Office. Spent 5 years there. Ultimately became a reservist during my time at the Prosecutor's Office. A spot opened there for me. And again, this is pre 9/11, when getting into the JAG Corps was a lot harder. Post 9/11, they basically said, we'll take anybody, including you. So I was able to get in and serve some time on active duty with the 18th Airborne Corps down at Fort Bragg as a military prosecutor, which was hands down one of the great professional experiences I've ever had and probably ever will have. And after returning from Fort Bragg, I ultimately joined the Graydon firm in January 2009. And that's where I continue. And frankly, that's where I was working at the Graydon firm, where I developed a lot of my interest in city law. I started within a few months of working there, was tapped by the, I guess it was all the way back to the Mallory administration at that point, to help represent the city's pension fund, which was at the time facing a lot of court challenges because of some of the benefits modifications which had occurred. And that representation sort of grew into, the partnership that we ultimately had with the Cranley administration. It's basically remaking the pension fund, which had been this, dark cloud hanging over the city's finances for about the preceding 10 years.
And keeping it solvent. I mean,
keeping it solvent.
They call it a historic deal. The mayor loves to call it that. Mm-hmm. And, I tend to shy away from that, but right. Not on this, because the pension is the biggest problem the city faces that no one really knows about, because if you say the word pension, nobody wants to talk about it. But this was really just this amazing deal. It's still very precarious as we go forward. And I think that it's probably going to be a big issue coming up again. And so, but I mean, that work is just, you say pension and you gloss over it, but is big deal work. It really is.
Right. I mean, and frankly, the pension is, it's one of those kind of too big to fail sort of concepts for us is, we have a pension fund that is valued at, anywhere from $2.8 to $3.2 billion given, given the time and position of the assets. And it is the city's single biggest liability. Because of the rules surrounding public pension plans, you can't invest as maybe as robustly and you have to invest in a very risk adverse sort of way, much more so than you would in your 401k. So when the market goes down, you feel the whole downside, but you don't always really realize the upside. So, I think it's going to have to probably be revisited in some way again. I would expect, 2021 is going to be a tough year because the early indications are that the fund suffered from the pandemic, but has not been able to receive the benefit of the full upside. you know, we everyone sort of thinks, well, God, the market's at 30,000. You know, how could the pension fund be hurting? You know, it's, you know, because we really can't take the kinds of market risks that that individuals can.
Your name first came up for a council role back when Amy Murray left for a job in Washington in February. You obviously, you've been involved with politics for a long time behind the scenes. You know, you've helped a lot of judicial candidates through the years, Republican. You clerked for former Judge Nadel. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yes.
And so you the whole the judicial side of Republican politics, you've been involved in for a long time. When did you find it kind of first get the itch or the desire to, you know, potentially be on council?
Well, you know, actually I first sort of flirted with it, gosh, all the way back in, I mean, believe it or not, 2003. I was like maybe 30 years old or something like that at the time, and a group of folks approached me about running then, and it just didn't feel like the right time. You know, I had extremely young children, you know, at the time, it just didn't feel like the right thing. But, you know, at the time, you know, I was still working in the county prosecutor's office, was sort of one of the handful of folks there that lived in the city and was sort of plugged into city issues, and, you know, was working a lot with the old Citizens on Patrol program, and had been involved in some pretty, you know, tough and contentious issues regarding liquor permits, you know, within the city, you know, at known trouble spots, and, you know, had really, you know, took a pretty deep dive, you know, into public safety issues within the city. And that was the first time someone had approached me about it. And just the timing wasn't right. And then the war happened, and, you know, I was gone from home a lot on active duty assignments and so forth with the reserves. And I just sort of put a pin in that, basically. And it really wasn't until the last 3 or 4 years, frankly, where, you know, working with the Cranley administration a bit, primarily on these, you know, fiscal issues, that it just felt, you know, felt like I really had something new to offer. You know, it's, I've testified and before, I couldn't tell you how many, you know, council meetings, and I've been sort of alarmed, I guess, by the sort of lack of fiscal literacy that underlies some of the questions, you know, that have been put forward. You know, and I thought, my God, you know, there needs to be a better stewardship of these funds. There needs to be better stewardship of our infrastructure. And we need people actually just to, frankly, be more adult about this and to manage this like you would your personal finances and like you would your personal business and like you would your personal safety and the safety of your children. And I've always been sort of, particularly in the last few years, just distressed by the raw political gamesmanship that you see. You know, there's times when, you know, one of the things that I do, I've got teenage girls, and I spend a lot of my time yelling at them to put their phones down when they're at the dinner table. And I feel like sometimes, you know, I'd be testifying at council and people are playing on their phones. You know, I'm like, hey, we're talking about something that's important here. You asked me to be here. So, I mean, you know, I mean, that may not be the most high flown or philosophical reason you know, to go, but it's just there was or to want to be on council. But there was just this sense I had of like, God, there just needs to be a different kind of more adult approach to this job. And that if nothing else, I can yell at people about their cell phones. I've proven I can do that. I do that very well. So, you know, that's not exactly Winston Churchill stuff, but I can yell at people about their cell phones.
You know, there's been a lot of proposals, like the change proposals that will be coming up and will be under discussion when City Hall reopens, it's closed for the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And these are very valuable conversations to have. But, I mean, it's clear that something has to happen. You know, whichever thing is coming, it's unclear, like, what's going to, you know, what this final thing is going to look like. But mm-hmm. something. Like, that's, we're just at a place where, you know, there has to be a change.
Well, I think that's right. And look, and there's some proposals that have been advanced already, you know, that are pretty thoughtful and pretty good. But I mean, it's got to be something much more comprehensive. But I mean, I guess the first thing I want to say is this, you don't need some sort of ethics officer or some sort of bureaucracy or a bunch of ethics classes to know, you shouldn't need them anyway, to know that taking bags of cash is wrong, to know that soliciting campaign contributions for council acts, you know, is wrong. I mean, there's no correcting, you know, for human nature. I mean, there is a certain, you know, character issue here, and part of the problem and part of the solution, I should say, is you're simply, you know, the citizens of Cincinnati are going to have to elect different kinds of people to these jobs. I know there's this, you know, proposal to have this commission that would look at development deals, and there certainly may be some merit to that, but you really can't outsource ethics, and the idea of just having some sort of ethics officer, I guess, who would sort of be in charge of all this stuff. I mean, to me, that feels like and there may be some merit to it, but it feels to me like a deflection. And I just keep thinking about my old boss in the Ohio legislature. He used to say, if you want to bury something, appoint a blue ribbon commission. Nothing will ever happen. And this feels a little bit to me like a blue ribbon commission.
Real quick, Charter Review Task Force Committee. Yeah. Oh, sorry. We had this huge involved people, citizens in this community, you know, gave countless hours to, right, you know, put in research, look at what really should be done to the charter. Mm-hmm. And four very, you know, basic, not life-changing things came out of it, when there was actually a recommendation to look at what should happen in the event that there is a problem like this. Mm-hmm. And you know where that went? Nowhere.
I know.
I've been reading this document, you know, going back over it and like, what happened here? And like, just 2 years of work, hard work, only to have it buried. It was buried. There's no other way to look at that. Because happened.
No, I don't disagree with your take on that. And I think that's part of the, in my mind, our charter is almost 100 years old. I mean, and it is out of date in many respects. It has guided us and guided us well. And it is a wonderful foundational document. It was one of the first of its kind in the United States. The fact that it professionalizes a lot of the city's business and removes a lot of the city's business from politics is a wonderful thing. And I think we need to go back to the spirit of that. But by the same token, you know, that original document, you know, does not even contemplate, you know, the kind of realities of modern municipal finance. I mean, there's, you know, tax increment financing didn't exist in 1924. You know, the kind of modern tax abatements we do didn't exist in 1924. You know, our pension system didn't exist in 1924. There are a lot of things that, you know, cellular communications and the ability in our modern open meetings and open records acts did not exist in 1924. It needs to be updated and kind of rethought in some ways in the spirit of the original document. And I think that's part of what folks are kind of grasping at here. And I think people are, you know, they're seeing the outlines of what they need to do, but I think the enormity of the problem is sort of still eluding folks. And I think I think the worst thing that could happen, Sherry, is that if if council comes in, passes a couple quick ordinances that are designed to, that address some of the low-hanging fruit type problems. Then there's a quick charter amendment that's passed in regards to removing council members who were accused of criminal conduct. I know that's proposed. I think that's a good idea, but I don't think it's enough. And then we close the book on this. I think we're missing a big opportunity if that's what happens.
Steve, how do you go about then that kind of what you're saying, this bigger, broader, sweeping reform? Like what's a general approach? And it sounds to me like you're going to be helping spearhead that. What does that look like?
Well, I hope to. And I mean, the first thing is bringing in, folks from outside City Hall. I'm telling you, as soon as, you know, as word of my appointment broke, I started getting input from folks, you know, across the spectrum, whether it be, you know, folks who are associated with the Charter Party, you know, folks in the business community. I mean, there's a lot of people who have a lot of thoughts here. And I think one of the things that I think we have to get away from conceptually is this sort of idea that the business community and developers specifically are adverse to these kinds of reforms or this kind of change. I mean, they want to know, I mean, the vast majority of them want to play by the rules. They just want to know what the rules are. And I think, you know, I don't know that we need to have another quote unquote blue ribbon committee and tear through things that way. I think there was a lot of good work there from the original commission that can be picked up. And a lot of this is stuff that we already know. And a lot of it's just a matter of forming some consensus among the various groups that are interested in these things and putting it to the voters and letting them ultimately decide.
You know what other study was buried? Sorry.
No, go ahead.
When you say things like that, it's the shared services one.
Absolutely.
Like nobody wanted any change. 2 years and they like no change. So you're right. There are documents there that really lay out things that have been done, but just, you know, not addressed. We have documents to work off of.
Right, and that's one of the things that, to me that, you know, like I said, I haven't even been to a council meeting yet, but I'm already frustrated. I mean, we know what's there. We know generally what needs to be done, you know. If we need a special ethics officer to convince people not to take bribes, then we have a bigger problem than we could have ever dreamed of, okay? If we need another charter review committee when all this great work has already been done and when we already know the history and intent of the charter, then, you know, we're just punting. We're deflecting. We're kicking the can down the road. In my mind, there's like, you know, this comes in three groups. If we're going to really fix this thing, there's three areas that we need to address. One is we can address in the very short term by ordinance some of the transparency issues that I think have led to the current mess in some ways, which is, you know, perhaps among other things, having a searchable database for city campaign contributions, which is something we, as I understand it, currently don't have. That information should be public. Being transparent about who is giving to what, I think, and to whom and when, I think what will solve part of the problems. I think if there was a greater sense of transparency around some of these the deals that this Elm Street property particularly, I think it would have scared off some folks. Number one. Number two, there is this more detailed, you know, there's parts of this that I think are going to have to be addressed by the voters via a more comprehensive series of charter amendments, perhaps presented as a package that will, add some checks and balances and, you know, recommit, particularly in the economic development area, to a more professional way of doing business and changing the way the city does business. And the third thing is, I think the voters are simply going to have to stop, you know, putting people on council, and I hope they will, who are there really just to build name ID and move on to something else. I mean, that's part of the problem. I mean, these are folks who, you know, sometimes the folks that get there see an opportunity to meet with a business leader because they see someone who might support them later on in their career. And that's the sort of approach that's occurring. And, nothing good could come of that.
Both Jason and I have faced, people saying, well, you know, this story's terrible. Mm-hmm. You know, what are people going to think when I run again? And it's like, we're writing about this now because citizens care about it, like whatever the topic might be. But we hear people like worried, you know, what things are going to look like because for their next thing. And it's like, that's not what we're concerned about when we write stories that are happening in City Hall or wherever Jason's covering in the region politically.
Well, right. And there's a tremendous amount of posturing that occurs. And some of it's, you know, partisan political posturing, and some of it's just, you know, personal posturing. And, I think we were talking before we went on the air here that, the biggest criticism I got yesterday was that I don't have social media accounts. I mean, I've had several, you know, political activists of both parties say, you know, you're insane. Why don't you have social media accounts? And I promised them I will put, you know, something together so that I can get some information out to folks. Cause I do know that, you know, those are, you know, important ways to disseminate information in 2020, but they also can lead to a coarsening and a really divisive kind of communication. And they have not been all the social media and so forth, particularly among, you know, some of the council members, has not been helpful during this time because it leads to this posturing. it leads to these kind of false presentations of who folks are. It leads to people playing to small groups of people and not thinking about the city as a whole. And it becomes sort of a weird, you know, echo chamber. My sense is by and large, it's the same 200 or 300 people, you know, who are on these, on Twitter, you know, weighing in over and over and over. And I don't think that reflects, the folks that I'm concerned about. I'm concerned about the small business owners. I'm concerned about the bank CEOs. I'm concerned about the people who are trying to get our downtown, you know, filled with people again as the pandemic wanes and trying to get, you know, our city working again, rather than play into a handful of folks on Twitter. And I think you see that in the council chambers, and it's all about this whole, you know, hope of political advancement and the ambition.
You've been watching city, as you mentioned, you've been watching city politics for a long time. You've been, as you mentioned, involved with some projects and helping with the pension. So, and you know Democrats, you know Republicans, you know independents. From your perspective now, coming in with a fresh approach, looking at this, where do you think things started to go wrong? Can you pinpoint something as to, you know, that a moment or a time or a project or a vote or something where this thing went off the rails?
I have a theory, okay, and I don't know that I'm right, but I have my personal theory is this, is that a large, you know, as most of your listeners will recall, a couple decades ago, the voters of Cincinnati amended the charter to allow for a strong mayor. I voted for that. I thought it was a good idea at the time. I think it's a good idea now. But a lot of the council members who are currently serving and who have served in preceding years never really seem to accept that. So as I read the charter, as I understand it, you know, our strong mayor working with a strong, working with the city manager and who, you know, oversees an economic development department, you know, can have legally and properly some involvement in economic development and helping, you know, steer projects and negotiate, incentive packages and things of that nature, and can do that in a perfectly lawful fashion. But some of the council members, again, in part, I think, due to their political ambitions, really wanted to insert themselves into that process. And I think you can see it happening gradually over time. And you see a situation where council members, some of whom have absolutely no experience in negotiating these kinds of deals, are coming to council trying to overrule the professionals, and the economic development professionals specifically, in terms of how these deals are going to go forward. And it is, When you see that, once that kind of genie got out of the bottle, that individual council members were going to be able to weigh in on these development deals, it was really only a matter of time before you saw this kind of graft and corruption. I mean, and so I think part of it was the sense of unfairness by politically ambitious council members, or their belief that it was unfair that the mayor and the city manager really kind of, you know, under the charter get to do this sort of work and sort of, you know, get to take credit for this sort of work. They were looking for ways to get into the process. They found ways into the process, and it was just a matter of time before stuff went wrong. I mean, because there's too much money flowing around these sorts of deals. So, I mean, that's my personal theory. It's just, and again, it's not a critique of the strong mayor form of government, but it's just the fact that I think certain folks who have been in public life in Cincinnati refused to accept it, maybe didn't understand it, didn't understand the implications of it, but I think that contains the seeds of how we got to where we are.
When we talk about the deals that are at the crux of what's going on now with corruption, 435 Elm Street, the mm-hmm. accusations from both Jeff Pastor and P.G. Sittenfeld relate to that project. Never once was that project discussed publicly. That was something that was being done behind the scenes with these mm-hmm. two council members. Clearly, I mean, they're quoted in the indictment, whether I'm not going to, you know, say whether, right. The charges are pending, like it's
right,
but
right.
We clearly see that they are discussing a project that was never once mentioned, you know, in City Hall, and not, you know, a sports betting book, not hatched by the Economic Development Department. And then we again see that in the deal that involves the hotel that Mr. Ndugwe is doing up on Reading Road. That the Economic Development Department actually said, well, it doesn't really fit the criteria of the things we're supposed to be doing. And council went forward with that anyway. And then we are seeing it again now with, you know, talking about, you know, extending tax abatements for this deal, you know, where the Economic Development Department is not even weighing in on whether it's a good idea or not.
Right.
And it's like we have professionals for a reason.
Well, and again, that goes, I hear what you're saying, and to me, that goes to the fundamentals of our charter form of government. I mean, the whole point of the, you know, of the charter, you know, was to professionalize and depoliticize a lot of the city's business. I mean, that's why we have a city manager who is appointed, not elected. I mean, that's why we have these department heads who have civil service protections and can't be removed just because they're, you know, they make a decision that is unpopular. You know, the Charterites, you know, are a lot like the Founding Fathers in a certain way. They were very clear-eyed about human nature and corruption and the potential for corruption and what politics can do to the city business. They understood it, and they put in, to the extent they could back in the 1920s, checks and balances. And that is the idea. So if we're not, I mean, it begs the question of why we should even have an Economic Development Department if we're going to work around them or view them as an obstacle or ignore what they do. And, you know, I've done other work for the city. I've represented the Economic Development Department. I actually represented them in a really contentious matter a number of years ago, where we clawed back incentives or clawed back a piece of property from a developer who, you know, did not perform as agreed to under his development agreement. So, you know, I've worked with those folks and have a great deal of respect for them. And they're there, you know, for a reason. And the idea that, again, that individual council members can have these kinds of discussions with, you know, about public dollars outside the public eye, I mean, is pretty galling. And it is exactly, I mean, it's, you know, it creates an environment in which it's amazing that that there hasn't been more corruption, frankly.
Something as you're talking here, it's brought up a thought that I think people have brought this up to me, that there's a lot of people on council don't have real jobs outside of council and don't have that kind of real world perspective. And yet, like you said, like you mentioned, that they're trying to cut development deals when you not necessarily have to have development experience, but I think there's something to be said for having a career outside of city council. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's crucial. And I mean, you know, when, first, I mean, I have no choice but to keep working. I mean, Brother Williams, I got child support, man. I gotta keep working. Okay. So I'm going to be working until I'm like 70 with my kids. So, I will, you know, I will continue to practice law. I will continue to be gainfully employed. Our law firm, you know, I work for the Graydon law firm, and, you know, there's been some, this was an easy conversation to have for them. I said, look, I'm not going to make as much money for you guys, you know, in 2021, you know, but I do think that there is a public service you can perform here. And those folks didn't hesitate. I mean, that's a law firm where a lot of folks, both Democrat and Republicans, you know, have come out of over the years to do a lot of public service. I mean, Pete Strauss, who was a great Democratic council member, worked there as an attorney full time and served on council part time. You know, also, you know, Rob Portman came from that firm, Bob Taft, and you know, a number of our federal judges, you know, started there. So it's a firm that values public service. So I'm very lucky to have some flexibility that way. And frankly, I've been there long enough that I'm a partner there, so they kind of have to put up with me. It's sort of like having tenure in at a college. You know, it's kind of hard to get fired. I guess it could happen. I shouldn't jinx it, but it's hard. But no, I think it's absolutely crucial that folks, you know, stay engaged in the real world. And a friend of mine who was a judge, you know, he told me right away, he's like, the most important thing you can do is stay, in a gainfully employed, dealing with folks outside of City Hall, away from the echo chamber. It's like you need that. You cannot let it consume you. You can't sit up till midnight, you know, trolling on your Twitter feed every night. Worrying what someone said about you. It's a job. Go in and do the job and do it to the best of your ability and walk away from it and keep your life.
Whoever told you that, it was great advice.
I'm going to out him. It was the great judge, the great and honorable Tyrone K. Yates, who also served on city council.
Yep.
Who I think is an outstanding and fine public servant. And I'm probably hurting him politically by praising him, but I'm going to do it anyway.
he deserves that praise, and that was great advice that he gave you.
Well, he's a good man, yep. And he's been through it.
Yep. Siri?
Have you gone? So you were in City Hall briefly yesterday. Like, what does this look like? Are you going to have like an office in there? Like, how do you kind of gear up, you know, for, we're supposed to have a meeting the second week of December. How do you kind of prepare for that so quickly?
You know, we're still kind of working that out, frankly. There is an office designated for me, but I'm not, I'm not allowed to see it, frankly. I do think that a fair amount of this, you know, the work is going to be done remotely here over the next couple of weeks. I'm working under the assumption that there will be a council meeting on December 14, and you know, we're starting to look at, potential, you know, already starting to look at some ordinances and, you know, thinking about things to introduce and thinking about things to do. I mean, we're hard at it. Obviously I'm going to have to make a lot of decisions about how the office is going to work and how the office is going to be staffed. And, really, frankly, that work is just, really starting today.
You talked about a lot of things you do want to do. Is there one thing that you are on, you know, when you come out of the gate or, you know, when there's that first council meeting that is a top priority?
Well, there's several top priorities. Yeah. I mean, frankly, I think the public really, really needs, wants, and expects, at the very least, a roadmap as to how the remaining council members are going to address what I've been calling systemic corruption. You know, and I think the sooner we speak to that in an intelligent and comprehensive way, the better. So, you know, we're working on some proposals. I'm working on some proposals, and maybe not everything is perfectly laid out on December the 14th. I wouldn't expect that. In fact, I would hope that is not the case. But I think the conversation has to begin, and I think we have to have a pretty good roadmap for folks. And what one of the things I've been kind of cautioning everyone I've talked to, and whether it be, you know, political folks or just citizens who, you know, ask me, I keep going back to something one of my law partners used to say, which is that for every complicated problem, there is a simple solution, and it is invariably wrong. I mean, it took us years to get here, and we're not going to get out of it overnight.
Yeah.
But I do think, that being said, that there are some things we can do in the very short term, particularly by ordinance as it relates to transparency, that can shed some sunlight on these, on at least some of these matters very quickly. I do think there's probably a deeper and longer conversation to be had about the charter. But the biggest thing I want to do is get this moving, get it done, and quickly turn in very short order to helping the city, you know, basically pick itself up again from this pandemic, getting our downtown reopened to the extent we can safely. And addressing some of the, and this is something that I'm kind of sad that we've been talking about all this corruption and all these other issues, but I mean, you know, we're having an historic uptick in violent crime on our streets. It's a huge problem for our neighborhoods, and again, I'm very mindful of that tension between, kind of, you know, our downtown business district, which is our jewel and which is so important. From a tax-based standpoint, but we cannot neglect our neighborhoods. Our neighborhoods are having a really hard time, particularly during this pandemic period that we're living through. So I think we need to really get back to addressing the basic services and the public safety issues that our neighborhoods are seeing. And it makes me kind of sick that those kind of concerns have been pushed aside for people shaking down developers and nonsense like this. It's an absolute shame. There are folks who are depending on the government to provide services to them, to provide safe streets for them, and that's being lost. And the fact that is not a priority in now of all times, you know, is simply, it's a disgusting state of affairs. And that's where I want to get. That's where I want to see City Hall focused again in very short order.
Great stuff, Steve. Sherry, is there anything else you want to ask?
Oh, I think we'll let him get to his first meeting and then ask him
that question. Yeah, we'll see how that goes.
Well, thanks.
I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you all and, keep asking us, tough questions. And I hope and anticipate that you ask questions that make me angry and uncomfortable at some point.
Well, thanks so much again for taking the time today, Steve, and all the best to you. And we'll look forward to covering you on City Council.
Thank you very much. You guys have a good day. Thanks.
You too. Bye-bye.
Take care.
All right. Thanks again to Steve Gooden and Sherry. Any takeaway there from our discussion with Steve?
You know, honestly, he used the word disgusting, and the words that I've heard from people to describe what's going on in the city is heartbreaking. It's just something I didn't expect. I mean, I said earlier, I'm still stunned about a lot of things that we're seeing happening. We've heard, U.S. Attorney Dave DeVillers hasn't shut the door on more things happening. He was on, you were on the radio yesterday interviewing him, and he said it again, directly asked, what's next? And he said, I can't talk about that. And, a lot of speculation there. And so he used that word, and other people have used similar words, and it's hard to hear, but just kind of chronicling what everyone's saying about this.
Yeah. I want to ask you something about that, Sherry, and you've talked a lot with Dave DeVillers, and not to veer too far off the path here. Obviously it's all regarded to City Hall. I was filling in on WLW yesterday for Eddie Fingers with Rocky Boyman, and we had him, Dave DeVillers, on, and the question was posed to him, hey, is this done? Let's say if it was done, do you think Dave DeVillers would say, yes, our cases are closed at City Hall and we've moved on? Or do you think by him saying I can't comment on that is basically him saying things aren't done yet?
I'm encouraging everyone not to speculate, but here I'll do that now.
Yeah.
I am. That's what I tell people.
You can't.
It's not, we've talked to him a little bit. He was on the podcast. I encourage people to listen to that episode. But we don't really know him. This isn't Joe Dieters, who's been an elected official in our community for decades, where, when he can kind of read between the lines. You can't do that here.
Yeah, good
but
point.
I will, that comment taken in tandem with things he said at the press conferences, these back-to-back press conferences related to Jeff Pastor's arrest and P.G. Sittenfeld's arrest, are the idea that this investigation is, still going on. He has said that. And so the question that we're talking about specifically was kind of what's next. And he just said he can't talk about it. So I think you kind of have to take them all as a whole and think that there just is still an investigation. But then I say, I cannot guess. I'm refusing to guess. No good comes from guessing. You're either going to guess somebody and feel bad about it later because you're wrong, or guess somebody and know you're right. It's a terrible feeling to guess. It really is.
It is. And, I'm glad you brought that up, because people have asked me, and I know people ask you, and, we all like to, talk politics and all. This is completely something different. I'm not going to speculate, even, just in a private conversation, if someone asks me about it, a reader asks me, or, they've asked me on WLW when I've been on, I'm just not going to speculate on it. You can speculate on, hey, I've said this, you speculate, hey, who might run for Congress in 2022? And here's three or four names of people. That's completely different than speculating on, who's under potential, federal investigation. That's just something I just don't feel like is just professional to speculate on. So I'm glad you brought that up. And yeah, certainly the political world in greater Cincinnati is a buzz right now about it. And if there's someone else or more people or whatever, but the bottom line is we don't know. And,
You know where I think we can see some speculation? It's like, who's going to run for council now? So that's like kind of the same yes. theme of like, who's running for Congress? You know, I thought we kind of knew most of the people, you know, not all, but most. I think this is making people rethink things. You know, today, as we record, Kevin Flynn, former councilman, is announcing his candidacy. Mm-hmm. And he said that someone's got to clean up this corruption. That was his words, not mine. And so, but I think there are others out there thinking, you know, they weren't going to maybe take this path. It's hard to run, you know, and it is a big job. It's going to be a lot of work, especially where things are at with, you know, a pandemic budget next year and, you know, all of the discussions that are happening around corruption. It is going to be a very tough job, but I think that we could see people that we didn't think that we would, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see, like, if there's kind of a, you know, good government / anti-corruption slate of council members who sort of come together and you know, run as, not an official team, but sort of run together. And I would think that Kevin Flynn, certainly, if that is the case, will be a part of that slate. And I know that Christopher Smitherman has talked about trying to recruit good government, you know, proponents to run for council next time. Obviously, he's term limited out.
Speaking of speculation, the mayor's race too. Speculation remains there. What are we taking turns asking if he's going to run for mayor? You ask him one day, I'll ask the next. If we're not doing that, we should. So he still hasn't made a decision yet.
Yeah, and we had him on the podcast last week, and great listenership on that episode. So if you did miss that, go back and check out that episode. Sherry, just again, certainly plenty for you and I to talk about and write about in your stories and my columns and our podcast here. And so I just encourage folks to stay locked in and stay tuned. Check out Cincinnati.com. If you don't have those subscriptions yet, Cincinnati.com/subscribe. Follow Sherry. She's our lead reporter on Cincinnati City Hall at Sharon Coolidge on Twitter. And check me out on Twitter too, at J Williams Cincy with a Y. And Sherry, it'll be you and I'll be, we'll be back here next week. And I'm sure we'll have another guest who is who knows what the news will be next week around all
things
this,
are moving so quickly. We play guests at the last second.
Absolutely. Yeah. We've been trying to keep that fluid right now. And like as today, you know, hey, just yesterday, the Steve Gooden thing was announced. We rushed and got him on. And so that's what we're trying to do. Hey, if you do have suggestions for guests, future guests, let us know on Twitter, as I mentioned, or email. scoolidge@inquirer.com or J Williams@inquirer.com, and we'll catch you next week. Thanks.